Her previous position had let her sense Gawain in the direction of the river. But after moving through the gateway, she had a better sense of his position. He wasn't at the river with Elaine's armies. Gawain was on the heights themselves, where the shadow held the strongest. "Oh, light," she thought. "Gawain, what are you doing?"
Gawain strode through smoke. Black tendrils of it curled around him, and the heat of smoldering grass warmed his boots. But the fire had mostly burned out here atop the heights, leaving the ground dark with ash. Bodies and some broken dragons lay blackened, like heaps of slag or coal. Gawain knew that sometimes, to renew a field, farmers would burn the previous year's weeds. The world itself was alight now. As he slipped through the twisting black smoke, his kerchief wetted and tied across his face, he prayed for a renewal. There were spiderweb cracks all over the ground. The shadow was destroying this land. Most of the Trollocs were gathering on the heights overlooking Howell Ford, though a handful busied themselves prodding at bodies on the slope. Perhaps they had been drawn by the scent of burning flesh. A murdrawl emerged from the smoke and began scolding them in a language Gawain did not understand. It lashed a whip at the Trolloc's backs. Gawain froze in place, but the half-man did not notice him. It drove the stragglers toward where the rest of the Trollocs had gathered. Gawain waited, breathing softly through his handkerchief, feeling the shadows of the blood knives wreathe him. The three rings had done things to him. He felt heady, and his limbs moved too quickly when he stepped. It had taken time to grow accustomed to the changes, to keep his balance each time he moved. A wolf-featured Trolloc rose up from behind a nearby pile of rubble and sniffed the air, looking after the fade. The Trolloc then crept out of hiding, a corpse thrown over its shoulder. It walked past Gawain, passing not 5 feet away, where it paused and sniffed the air again. Then, hunching low, it continued. The body it carried over its shoulder trailed the cloak of a warder. Poor Simon. He would never play another hand of cards. Gawain growled softly, and before he could stop himself, leaped forward. He moved into kissing the adder, spinning and relieving the Trolloc's shoulders of its head. The carcass crashed down to the ground. Gawain stood with sword out, then cursed himself, crouching and moving back into the smoke. It would mask his scent, and the twisting blackness his blurred form. Fool to risk exposing himself to kill one Trolloc. Simon's corpse would end up in a cookpot anyway. Gawain couldn't kill the entire army. He was here for one man. Gawain crouched, waiting to see if his attack had been noticed. Perhaps they wouldn't have been able to see him. He wasn't certain how much the rings clouded him, but anyone watching would have seen the Trolloc fall. No warning call. Gawain rose and continued. Only then did he notice that his fingers were showing red among the black of the ash. He had burned them. The pain was distant. The rings. He had difficulty thinking straight, but that didn't, fortunately, stop his ability to fight. If anything, his instincts were stronger now. Demandred. Where was Demandred? Gawain sped back and forth across the top of the heights. Cawthon had troops stationed at the river near the ford, but the smoke made it impossible to see who was involved. On the other side, the borderlanders were engaged with a Sharan cavalry unit. Yet here, on top, it was peaceful, despite the presence of Shadowspawn and Sharans. Now Gawain crept along the back lines of the Shadowspawn, keeping to the rougher patches of dead wood and weeds. Nobody seemed to notice him. There were shadows here, and shadows were protection. Down below, in the corridor between heights and bog, the fires were going out. That seemed too quick for them to have burned themselves out. Channeling? He had intended to find Demandred by seeking the origin of the man's attacks, but if he was just channeling to put out fires, then... The Shadow's army charged, racing down the slope toward Howell Ford. Though the Sharans remained behind, the bulk of the Trollocs moved. They obviously intended to push over the now dry riverbed and engage Cawthon's army. If Cawthon had intended to lure all of Demandred's forces off the heights, he had failed. Many Sharans remained behind, infantry and cavalry units watching impassively as the Trollocs thundered toward battle. Explosions pounded along the slope, throwing Trollocs into the air like dirt from a beaten rug. Gawain hesitated, crouching low. Dragons. The few working ones. Matt had set them up somewhere across the river. It was difficult to see an exact position because of the smoke. By the sound, there were only half a dozen or so, but the damage they caused was enormous, particularly considering the distance. A burst of red light from nearby atop the heights launched toward the smoke of the dragons. Gawain smiled. "Thank you kindly." He put his hand on his sword. Time to test just how good these rings worked. He dashed, low and quick, out of cover. Most of the Trollocs were piling down the slope, loping toward the dry riverbed. Crossbow bolts and arrows assaulted them, and another round of dragon fire came from a slightly different location. Coffin had the dragons moving, and Demondred had trouble pinpointing them. Gawain ran between howling shadow spawn. The ground thumped like a beating heart from the impacts along the ground behind him. Smoke whipped around him, thick in his throat. His hands had been blackened, and he assumed his face had been as well. He hoped that would keep him hidden. Trollocs turned about, screeching or grunting, but none of them fixed upon him. They knew something had passed, but to them he was merely a blur. Egwene's anger poured through the bond. Gawain smiled. He had not expected her to be pleased. As he ran, arrows slicing the earth around him, he found peace with his choice. Once, perhaps, he would have done this for the pride of the battle and the chance to pit himself against Demondred. That was not his heart now. His heart was the need. Someone had to fight this creature, someone had to kill him, or they would lose this battle. They could all see it. Risking Egwene or Loghain would be too great a gamble. Gawain could be risked. No one would send him to do this, no one would dare. But it was necessary. He had a chance to change things, to really matter. He did it for Andor, for Egwene, for the world itself. Ahead, Demondred bellowed his now familiar challenge,
"Send me Althor! Not these so-called dragons!"
Another streak of fire flew from him. Gawain passed the charging Trollocs and came up behind a large group of Sharans with strange bows, almost as big as those of the two rivers. They surrounded a mounted man in interlinking armor of coins, bound at holes in the centers, with a gorget and arm guards. The faceplate on his fearsome helmet was open. That proud face was eerily familiar to Gawain, handsome and imperious. "This will have to be quick," Gawain thought, "and light I'd better not give him a chance to channel." The Sharan archers stood at the ready, but only two of them turned as Gawain slipped between them. Gawain pulled his knife from his belt sheath. He'd have to drag Demondred off his horse, then go for the face with his knife. It felt like a coward's attack, but it was the best way. Trip him, and Gawain could. Demondred spun suddenly and looked toward Gawain. A second later, the man thrust his hand forward and a beam of white-hot fire, thin as a twig, shot for Gawain. It missed, striking just beside Gawain as he leaped away. Cracks opened all across the ground nearby. Deep, black cracks that seemed to open into eternity itself. Gawain leaped forward, cutting at Demondred's saddle. So fast! These rings let him react while Demondred was still staring in confusion. The saddle came off, and Gawain rammed his knife into the horse's side. The beast screamed and reared, throwing Demondred backward, saddle and all. Gawain leaped, bloodied knife out, as the horse bolted, and the Sharan archers cried out. He loomed over Demondred, knife raised in two hands. The Forsaken's body suddenly jolted, and the man was pushed to the side. Air blew about the blackened ground, raising flakes of ash as weaves of air caught Demondred and spun him about, depositing him on his feet with a clink, sword unsheathed. The Forsaken crouched and released another weave. Gawain felt air spinning next to him, as if threads of it had tried to grab him. He was too quick, and Demondred obviously had trouble hitting him because of the rings. Gawain backed away and switched his knife to his offhand, unsheathing his sword in his right.
So, Demendred said, an assassin. And Luce Theron always spoke of the honor of facing a man face to face.
I wasn't sent by the Dragon Reborn.
With night's shade surrounding you, a weave that none from this age remember. Do you know that what Luce Theron has done to you will leak your life away? You are dead, little man.
Then you can join me in the grave, Gawain said. Demendred stood up, taking his sword in two hands in an unfamiliar battle stance. He seemed able to track Gawain somewhat despite the rings, but his responses were a hair slower than they should have been. Apple blossoms in the wind with three quick strikes forced Demendred back. Several Sharans came forward with swords, but Demendred raised a gauntleted hand to warn them off. He did not smile at Gawain. This man did not seem as if he ever smiled, but he performed something that was similar to lightning of three prongs. Gawain replied with the boar rushes down the mountain. Demendred was good. With the edge granted by the rings, Gawain narrowly escaped Demendred's riposte. The two danced through a small circle of open ground guarded by the watching Sharans. Distant booms threw iron spheres at the hillside, making the ground shake. There were only a few dragons still firing, but they seemed to be concentrating on this position. Gawain grunted, throwing himself into Storm Shakes the Branch, trying to push inside Demendred's guard. He would need to be close and ram his sword into the armpit or between the seams of the coin armor. Demendred responded with skill and finesse. Gawain was soon sweating beneath his mail. He felt faster than he'd ever been, his reactions like the darting movements of a hummingbird. Yet try as he did, he could not land a hit.
"Who are you, little man?" Demendred growled, walking back with sword raised at his side. "You fight well."
"Gawain Trakand."
"The little queen's brother," Demendred said. "You realize who I am?"
"A murderer."
"And your dragon has not murdered?" Demendred said. "Has your sister never killed to keep, dare I say, seize her throne?"
"That's different."
"So everyone always says." Demendred stepped forward.
His sword forms were smooth, his back always straight but relaxed, and he used the broad, sweeping movements of a dancer. He had absolute mastery of his sword. Gawain had not heard that Demendred was known for his swordsmanship, but this man was as good as any man Gawain had ever faced. Better, truly. Gawain performed cat dances on the wall, a beautiful sweeping sword form that matched Demendred's. Then he ducked in with the serpent's tongue dances, hoping his previous form would have lulled Demendred into letting a thrust slip past. Something crashed into Gawain, throwing him to the ground. He rolled, coming up in a crouch. His breathing grew labored. He did not feel pain because of the rings, but he had probably broken a rib. "A rock," Gawain thought. "He channeled and brought a rock in to hit me." He had trouble hitting Gawain with weebs because of the shadows, but something large could be tossed at the shadows and still hit him.
"You cheat," Gawain said with a sneer.
"Cheat?" Demendred asked. "Are there rules, little swordsman? As I recall, you tried to stab me in the back while hiding in a shroud of darkness."
Gawain breathed in and out, holding his side. A dragon's iron sphere thumped into the ground just a short distance away, then exploded. The blast ripped apart some Sharans, their bodies shielding Gawain and Demendred from the brunt of the blast. The soil rained down, like a spray of surf on the deck of a ship. At least one of the dragons was still working.
"You name me a murderer," Demendred said, "and I am. I am also your savior, whether you wish it or not."
"You're mad."
"Hardly."
Demendred walked around him, cutting the air with a few sweeps of his sword.
"That man you follow, Luce Theron Telamon, he is mad. He thinks he can defeat the Great Lord. He cannot. That is simple fact."
"You'd have us join the Shadow instead?"
"Yes." Demendred's eyes were cold. "If I kill Luce Theron, in victory I will be given the right to remake the world as I wish. The Great Lord cares nothing for rule. The only way to protect this world is to destroy it, and then shelter its people. Is that not what your dragon claims he can do?"
"Why do you keep calling him my dragon?" Gawain said, then spat blood to the side. The rings, they urged him forward. His limbs pulsed with strength, energy. Fight. Kill.
You follow him, Demendred said.
I do not.
Lies, Demendred said. Or perhaps you are simply fooled. I know that Luz Theron leads this army. At first I was uncertain, but no longer. That weave about you is proof enough, but I have a greater one. No mortal general has such skill as this day has shown. I face a true master on the battlefield. Perhaps Luz Theron wears the Mask of Mirrors, or perhaps he leads by sending messages to this coffin through the One Power. It does not matter, I see the truth. I dice with Luz Theron this day. I was always the better general. I will prove it here. I would have you tell that to Luz Theron, but you will not live long enough, little swordsman. Prepare yourself.
Demendred raised his sword. Gawain stood, dropping his knife, taking his sword in two hands. Demendred stalked toward him, using forms that were different from those Gawain knew. They were still familiar enough for him to counter, but despite his greater speed, time and time again Demendred caught his sword and deflected it harmlessly to the side. The man did not strike. He barely moved, feet set wide apart, sword in two hands, battering aside each and every attack Gawain hurled at him. The dove takes flight, the falling leaf, leopard's caress. Gawain gritted his teeth, growling through them. The rings should have been enough. Why weren't the rings enough? Gawain stepped back, then ducked backward as another stone came hurtling toward him. It missed him by inches.
Thank the light for these rings, he thought.
You fight with skill, Demendred said. For one of this age. But you still wield your sword, little man.
What else would I do?
Become the sword yourself, Demendred said, as if baffled that Gawain did not understand.
Gawain growled and came in again, battering at Demendred. Gawain was still faster. Demendred didn't attack. He was on the defensive then, although he didn't retreat. He just stood there, turning aside each blow. Demendred closed his eyes. Demendred said, as if baffled that Gawain did not understand. Gawain growled and came in again, battering at Demendred. Gawain was still faster. Demendred didn't attack. He was on the defensive then, although he didn't retreat. He just stood there, turning aside each blow. Demendred closed his eyes. Gawain smiled, then thrust in Black Lance's last strike. Demendred's sword became a blur. Something struck Gawain. He gasped, pulling to a stop. He wobbled and fell to his knees, looking down at a hole in his gut. Demendred had thrust straight through the mail, then pulled his sword free in a single fluid motion.
Why can't I feel anything?
If you do survive this and see Luz Theron, Demendred said, tell him I am very much looking forward to a match between the two of us, sword against sword. I have improved since we last met.
Demendred whipped his sword around, catching the back of the blade in the crook between his thumb and forefinger. He pulled the sword across, stripping the blood from the steel and splattering it to the ground. He slid the weapon into his sheath. He shook his head, then released a ball of fire toward a still-firing dragon. It fell silent. Demendred strode away along the edge of the steep slope facing the river, his Sharan guard forming around him. Gawain collapsed to the ground, stunned, spurting his life onto the burned grass. He tried to hold in the blood through trembling fingers. Somehow Gawain managed to push himself up to his knees. His heart cried out. He needed to return to Egwene. He began to crawl, blood mixing with the earth beneath him as it seeped from his wound. Through eyes clouded with cold perspiration, he spotted several cavalry mounts 20 paces ahead, poking at blackened tufts of grass at their feet and tethered to a picket line. After minutes of struggle, an impossible interval of time that left him drained, he pulled himself up onto the back of the first horse he could reach and untether. Gawain hunched over, dazed, grasping its mane in one hand. Summoning his remaining strength, he kicked his heel into the animal's ribcage.
"My lady," Mandevwin said to Fail, "I have known those two men for years. They are not without a few spots in their past. No man comes to the band without a few of those, but light provide, they are not dark friends." Fail ate her midday rations in silence, listening with as much patience as she could muster to Mandevwin's protests. She wished Perrin were here so she could have a good argument. She felt as if she would burst from pressure. They were close to Thakandar, horribly close. The black sky rumbled with lightning, and they hadn't seen a living creature, dangerous or not, in days. Nor had they seen Vannin or Harnan again, though Fail set a double guard each night. The minions of the Dark One did not give up. She now carried the horn in a large bag, tied to her waist. The others knew it, and moved between pride in their duty and horror at the import of it. At least she shared that with them now. "My lady," Mandevwin said, kneeling down. "Vannin is out there nearby somewhere. He is a very gifted scout, the best in the band. We will not see him unless he wants us to, but I would swear that he is following us. Where else would he go? Perhaps if I call out to him, invite him in to tell his story so we can resolve this."
"I will consider it, Mandevwin," Fail said. He nodded. The one-eyed man was a good commander, but had the imagination of a brick. Uncomplicated men assumed others to have uncomplicated motivations, and he could not imagine someone like Vannin or Harnan helping the band for so long, under orders, undoubtedly, to avoid suspicion, only to now do something so terrible. At least now she knew that she hadn't been worried without cause. That look of pure terror in Vannin's eyes when he'd been caught was confirmation enough, if catching him with a horn in his hands hadn't been. She had not expected two dark friends, and they had outsmarted her in their thievery. However, they had also underestimated the dangers of the Blight. She hated to think what would have happened if they hadn't drawn the attention of the bear thing. Fail would have remained in her tent, anticipating the arrival of thieves, who had already disappeared with one of the most powerful artifacts in the world. The sky rumbled. Dark Shale Ghoul loomed ahead, rising out of the valley of Thakandar in a range of smaller mountains. The air had grown chill, almost wintry. Reaching that peak would be difficult, but one way or another she was going to bring this horn to the forces of the Light for the last battle. She rested her fingers on the sack at her side, feeling the metal within. Nearby, Alvar scampered across the lifeless gray rock of the blasted lands, wearing his knife at his belt like a sword. Perhaps she should not have brought him. Then again, boys his age in the borderlands learned to run messages and carry supplies to besieged forts. They wouldn't go out with a warband or be given a post until they were at least 12, but their training started much earlier.
"My lady."
Fail looked toward Salanda and Arala as they approached. Fail had put Salanda in charge of the scouts, now that Vannin had revealed himself. The pale little woman looked less like an Aiel than many of the others in Shah Fail, but the attitude helped.
"Yes."
"Movement, my lady," Salanda said softly.
"What?" Fail stood. "What kind?"
"Some kind of caravan."
"In the blasted lands?" Fail asked. "Show me." It wasn't just a caravan. There was a village out there. Fail could make it out through the looking glass, though only as a smudge of darkness to indicate buildings. It was settled into the foothills near Thakandar. A village.
Light!
Fail moved the looking glass down to where a caravan crept across the bleak landscape, heading toward a supply station set up a good distance outside the village.
"They're doing what we did," she whispered.
What's that, my lady?
Arala lay on her stomach beside Fail. Mandevwin was on her other side, peering through his own looking glass.
It's a central supply station, Fail explained, looking over the stacks of boxes and bundles of arrows. Shadowspawn can't move through gateways, but their supplies can. They needn't have carried arrows and replacement weapons as part of the invasion. Instead, the supplies are being collected here, then sent to the battlefields when needed. Indeed, down below, a ribbon of light announced a gateway opening. A large train of dirty-looking men trudged through it with packs on their backs, followed by dozens of others pulling small carts.
Wherever those supplies are going, Fail said slowly, there will be fighting nearby. Those carts carry arrows, but no food, as the Trollocs are dragging corpses away to feast on each night.
So, if we could slip through one of those gateways, Mandevwin said.
Arala snorted, as if the conversation were a joke. She looked at Fail and the smile slipped from her lips.
You're serious. Both of you.
We are still a long hike from Thakandar, Fail said. And that village blocks our way. It might be easier to sneak through one of those gateways than try to work our way into the valley. We'd end up behind enemy lines.
We're already behind their lines, Fail said grimly. So nothing would change there.
Arala fell silent.
That will be a problem, Mandevwin said softly, turning his looking glass. Look at the fellows approaching the camp from the village.
Fail raised her looking glass again.
Aiel? She whispered. Light! The Shido have joined with the forces of the Dark One?
Even the Shido dogs would not do that, Arala said, then spat to the side. The newcomers did look different. They wore their veils up, as if for killing, but the veils were red. Either way, sneaking past Aiel would be nearly impossible. Likely only the fact that her group was so distant had saved them from discovery. That, and the fact that no one would expect to find a group like Fail's here.
Back, Fail said, inching back down the hillside. We need to do some planning.
Perrin awoke, feeling as if he had been tossed into a lake during winter. He gasped.
Lie down, you fool, Janina said, putting her hand on his arm.
The flaxen-haired wise one looked as exhausted as he felt. He was in some place soft, too soft. A nice bed, clean sheets. Outside the windows, waves broke gently against a shore and gulls called. He also heard moans echoing from some place nearby.
"Where am I?" Perrin asked.
"At my palace," Berylaine said.
She stood near the doorway, and he hadn't noticed her before. The first wore her diadem, the hawk in flight, and had on a crimson dress with yellow trim. The room was lavish, with gold and bronze on the mirrors, windows, and bedposts.
"I might add," Berylaine said, "that this is a somewhat familiar situation for me, Lord Ebara. I took precautions this time, in case you were wondering."
"Precautions?" Perrin sniffed the air.
"Uno?"
He could smell the man. Indeed, Berylaine nodded to the side, and Perrin turned to find Uno sitting in a chair nearby, his arm in a sling.
"Uno, what happened to you?" Perrin asked. "Bloody Trollocs happened to me," Uno grumbled. "Waiting my turn for healing."
"Those with life-threatening wounds are healed first," Janina said.
She was the most accomplished of the wise ones at healing. She'd apparently decided to stay with the Aes Sedai in Berylaine.
"You, Perrin Ebara, were healed to the point of survival. Only just to the point of survival. It wasn't until now that we could take care of the wounds that did not threaten your life."
"Wait," Perrin said.
He struggled to sit. Light, he was exhausted.
How long have I been here?
10 hours, Berylane said.
10 hours? I have to go.
The fighting will continue without you, Berylane said. I'm sorry.
Perrin growled softly.
So tired.
Moraine knew a method of wiping away a man's fatigue. Do you know this, Janina?
I wouldn't do it for you if I did, Janina said. You need sleep, Perrin Ibarra. Your participation in the last battle is over.
Perrin gritted his teeth, then moved to stand.
Step out of that bed, Janina said, turning her eyes toward him, and I'll bundle you in air and leave you hanging there for hours.
Perrin's first instinct was to shift away. He began forming the thought in his head and felt foolish. He'd somehow returned to the real world. He couldn't shift here. He was as helpless as a babe. He leaned back in his bed, frustrated.
Be of good cheer, Perrin, Berylane said softly, walking up to the bed. You should be dead. How did you reach that battlefield? If Harald Luhan and his men hadn't spotted you lying there...
Perrin shook his head. What he'd done defied explanation for one who did not know the wolf dream.
What is happening, Berylane? The war. Our armies.
She pursed her lips.
I can smell the truth on you, Perrin said. Worry? Anxiety?
He sighed.
I saw that the battlefronts had moved. If the Two Rivers men are at the Field of Marilor as well, all three of our armies have been pushed back to the same place. Everyone but those at Thakandar.
We don't know how the Lord Dragon is doing, she said softly,
gliding onto a stool beside his bed. Beside the wall, Janina took Uno by the arm. He shivered as the healing coursed through him.
Rand still fights, Perrin said.
Too much time has passed, she said.
There was something she wasn't telling him, something she was dancing around. He could smell it on her.
Rand still fights, Perrin repeated. If he had lost, we wouldn't be here.
He leaned back, exhaustion deep in his bones.
Light. He couldn't just lie here while men died, could he?
Time is different at the Boar. I visited it and saw firsthand. It has been many days out here, but I'll bet it has only been a day for Rand, maybe less.
That is well. I will pass what you say to the others.
Berylane, Perrin said. I need you to do something for me. I sent Elias with a message to our armies, but I don't know if he delivered it. Grendel is interfering with the minds of our great captains. Will you find out for me if his message arrived?
It arrived, she said. Almost too late, but it arrived. You did well. Sleep now, Perrin.
She rose.
Berylane?
He asked. She turned back to him.
Fayil, he said. What of Fayil?
Her anxiety sharpened.
No.
Her supply caravan was destroyed in a bubble of evil, Perrin, Berylane said softly. I'm sorry.
Was her body recovered?
He forced himself to ask.
No.
Then she still lives.
It...
She still lives,
Perrin insisted. He would have to assume that was true. If he didn't...
There is, of course, hope, she said,
then walked to Uno, who was flexing his healed arm, and nodded for him to join her as she left the room. Janina was puttering around the washstand. Perrin could still hear moaning in the hallways outside, and the place smelled of healing herbs and of pain.
Light,
he thought. Fael's caravan carried the horn. Did the shadow now have it? And Gaul. He had to return to Gaul. He'd left the man in the wolf dream guarding Rand's back. If Perrin's exhaustion was any guide, Gaul couldn't hold much longer. Perrin felt as if he could sleep for weeks. Janina returned to his bedside, then shook her head.
There is no good purpose in trying to force yourself to hold your eyes open, Perrin Ibarra.
I have too much to do, Janina. Please. I need to return to the battlefield and—
You will stay here, Perrin Ibarra. You are of no use to anyone in your state, and will gain no G by trying to prove otherwise. If the blacksmith who brought you here knew I'd let you stumble off and die on the battlefield, I believe he'd come try to hang me out the window by my heels. She hesitated. And that one, I almost think he could manage it.
Master Luhan, Perrin said, recalling faintly those moments before he blacked out. He was there. He found me?
He saved your life, Janina said. That man threw you on his back and ran you to an Aes Sedai for a gateway. You were seconds from death when he arrived. Considering your size, just lifting you was some feat.
I don't really need sleep, Perrin said, feeling his eyes droop. I need to get...
I'm sure you do, Janina said. Perrin let his eyes shut. That would convince her that he was going to do as she said. Then, when she left, he could stand up. I'm sure you do, Janina repeated, her voice growing softer for some reason. Sleep, he thought.
I'm falling asleep.
Again, he saw the three paths before himself. This time, one led to ordinary sleep, another to the wolf dream while sleeping, the path he usually took. And between them, a third path, the wolf dream in the flesh. He was sorely tempted, but in the moment he chose not to take that path. He chose ordinary sleep, as, in a moment of understanding, he knew that his body would die without it. Andral lay, gasping for breath, staring up at the sky somewhere far from the battlefield, following their flight from the top of the heights. That attack, it had been so powerful.
What was that?
He sent to Bavara. It wasn't Taim, she replied, standing up, dusting off her skirts. I think it was Dimandret.
I purposely brought us to a place far from where he was fighting.
Yes. How dare he move and interfere with the group of channelers attacking his forces? Andral sat up, groaning.
You know, Pabara, you are unusually smart-lipped for an Aes Sedai.
He was surprised by her amusement.
You don't know Aes Sedai nearly as well as you assume.
She walked over to check on Imaran's wounds. Andral took a deep breath, filled with the sense of autumn. Fallen leaves, stagnant water, an autumn that had come too early. Their hillside looked down on a valley where, in defiance of the way the world was going, some farmers had tilled the earth in large squares. Nothing had grown. Nearby, Theodrin pulled herself up.
It's madness back there, she said,
her face flushed. Andral could feel Pabara's disapproval. The girl should not have been so free with her emotions. She hadn't learned proper Aes Sedai control yet.
She isn't a proper Aes Sedai, Pabara sent him, reading his thoughts. Regardless of what the Amarlin claims, she hasn't been through the testing yet.
Theodrin seemed to know what Pabara thought, and the two kept their distance from one another. Pabara healed Imaran, who took it stoically. Theodrin healed a cut on Jonath's arm. He seemed bemused at the motherly ministration.
She'll have him bonded before long, Pabara sent him. Notice how she let one of the other women take her one of the 50, then started following him about? We've barely been rid of her since the Black Tower.
What if he bonds her back? Andral said.
Then we'll see if what you and I have is unique or not.
Pabara hesitated.
We are stumbling upon things that have never been known.
He met her eyes. She was referring to whatever had happened during their linking this last time. She had opened a gateway, but had done it as he would have.
We're going to need to try that again, he sent her.
Shortly, she said, delving Imaran to be certain her healing had taken. I am quite all right, Pavara Sedai, he said, courteous as always. And if I might note, you seem as if you could use some healing of your own.
She looked down at the burned cloth on her arm. She was still timid about letting a man heal her, but also annoyed at her own timidity.
Thank you,
she said, her voice level as she let him touch her arm and channel. Andral hooked the small tin cup from his belt and absently lifted his hand, fingers downward. He pressed his fingers as if pinching something between them, and when he spread them, a small gateway opened in the middle. Water poured out, filling the cup. Pivara sat down beside him, accepting the cup as he offered it. She drank, then sighed.
As cool as mountain spring water.
That's what it is, Andral said.
That reminds me. I've been meaning to ask you something. How do you do that?
Do this, he said. It's just a small gateway.
That's not what I mean, Andral. You've just got here. You couldn't possibly have had time to memorize this area well enough to open a gateway to some mountain spring hundreds of miles away.
Andral stared blankly at Pavara, as if he had just heard a surprising piece of news.
I don't know. Maybe it's something to do with my talent.
I see. Pavara was silent a moment.
By the way, what happened to your sword?
Andral reached by reflex to his side. The sheath hung there, empty. He'd dropped his sword when the lightning had struck near them, and he hadn't had the presence of mind to grab it as they fled. He groaned.
Garfin would send me to grind barley at the quartermaster's for weeks straight if he heard of this.
It's not that important, Pivara said. You have better weapons.
It's the principle, Andral said. Carrying a sword reminds me. It's like, well, seeing a net reminds me of fishing around Mayenne, and spring water reminds me of Jane. Small things. But small things matter. I need to be a soldier again. We have to find Taim, Pavara. The seals.
But we can't find him the way we've been trying. Do you agree? He sighed, but nodded.
Excellent, she said. I hate being a target. What do we do instead?
We approach this with careful study, not with swinging swords. She probably had a point.
And what we did? Pavara, you used my talent.
We shall see, she said, sipping from her cup. Now, if only this were tea. Andral raised his eyebrows. He took the cup back, opened a small gateway between two fingers, and dropped a few dried tea leaves into the cup. He boiled it for a moment with a thread of fire, then dropped in some honey through another gateway.
Had some back in my workshop in the Black Tower, he said, handing the cup back. It looks like nobody moved it.
She sipped the tea, then smiled warmly.
Andral, you are wonderful.
He smiled. Light. How long had it been since he'd felt this way about a woman? Love was supposed to be something for young fools, wasn't it? Of course, the young fools never could see straight. They'd look for a pretty face and stop there. Andral had been around long enough to know that a pretty face was nothing compared to the type of solidity a woman like Pavara displayed. Control, steadiness, determination. These were things that only proper seasoning could bring. It was the same way with leather. New leather was fine, but really good leather was leather that had been used and worn, like a strap that had been cared for over the years. You never knew for certain if you could rely on a new strap. Once it had been your companion for a few seasons, you knew.
I'm trying to read that thought, Pivara said. Did you just compare me to an old strap of leather?
He blushed.
I assume it's a leather worker's thing.
She sipped her tea.
Well, you keep comparing me to, what is it? A bunch of little figurines?
She smiled.
My family.
The ones killed by dark friends.
I'm sorry. It happened very, very long ago, Andral.
He could sense that she was still angry about it, though.
Light, he said. I keep forgetting that you're older than most trees, Babara.
Hmm, she said. First I'm a strap of leather, now I'm older than trees. I assume that despite the several dozen jobs you've had in your life, none of your training involves how to speak with a lady?
He shrugged. When younger, he might have been embarrassed to have his tongue tied in such knots. But he'd learned that there was just no way to avoid it. Trying to do so only made it worse. Oddly, the way he reacted pleased her. Women like to see a man flummoxed, he supposed. Her mirth died down, however, as she happened to glance at the sky. He was reminded suddenly of the empty fields below, the dead trees, the growling thunder. This was not a time for mirth, not a time for love. For some reason, though, he found himself clinging to both precisely because of that.
"We should be moving soon," he said. "What is your plan?"
"Taim will always be surrounded by minions. If we continue attacking as we have, we'll be cut to ribbons before we can get to him. We need to reach him stealthily."
"And how are we going to manage that?"
"That depends. How crazy can you be, if the situation warrants?"
The valley of Thakandar had become a place of smoke, mayhem, and death. Ruark stalked through it, Trask and Baldur at his sides. They were brothers of his from the Red Shields. He had never met these two before coming to this place, but they were brothers nonetheless, and their bond had been sealed by the spilled blood of Shadowspawn and traitors. Lightning broke the air, striking nearby. As Ruark walked, his feet crunched on sand that had been turned to shards of glass by the lightning. He reached cover, some Trolloc corpses in a pile, and crouched down, Trask and Baldur joining him. The tempest had finally come, furious winds assaulting the valley, nearly enough to pull the veil from his face. It was difficult to make out anything. The fog had blown away, but the sky had darkened and the storm kicked up dust and smoke. Many people fought in prowling packs. There were no more battle lines. Earlier in the day, a Murdral attack, and an all-out Trolloc assault afterward, had finally broken the defenders' hold on the mouth of the valley. The Tyrans and Dragonsworn had pulled back into the valley toward Shael Ghul, and now most of them fought near the base of the mountain. Fortunately, the Trollocs that had piled through didn't have overwhelming numbers. The killing in the pass and the long siege had reduced the numbers of Trollocs at Thakandar. In all, the Trollocs remaining probably equaled the number of defenders. That still would be a problem. But in his opinion, the honorless who wore red veils were a far greater threat. Those roved across the expanse of the valley, as did the Aiel. In this open killing field, obscured with fog and swirling dust to ruin visibility, Ruark hunted. Occasionally he would run across Trollocs in groups, but most had been driven by the Fades to fight the regular forces, the Tyrans and Domani. Ruark waved to his brothers and they moved through the tempest along one side of the valley. The light said that the regular forces and the Channelers could hold the path up to the mountain where the Karakarn fought Sightblinder. Randall Thor would need to complete his battle soon, for Ruark suspected it would not be long before the Shadow won this valley. He and his brothers passed a group of Aiel dancing the spears with the traitors who wore red veils. While many of the red veils could channel, it seemed that none in this group could. Ruark and his two leaped into the dance, spears thrusting. These red veils fought well. Trask woke from the dream during this fight, though he slew one of the red veils as he fell. The skirmish ended when the remaining red veils fled. Ruark killed one of them with the bow, and Baldur downed another, shooting men in the back. It was a thing they would not have done if fighting true Aiel. These creatures were worse than Shadowspawn. The three remaining Aiel they had helped nodded in thanks. They joined with him and Baldur, and together they moved back toward the Pit of Doom to check on the defenses there. Thankfully, the army at this place still held. Many were of Dragonsworn who had come to the battle last, and who were made up primarily of common men and women.
Yes, there were some Aes Sedai among them, even some Aiel and a couple of Ashaman. However, most of them held old swords that hadn't seen use in years, or staffs that had probably once been farming tools. They fought like cornered wolves against the Trollocs. Ruark shook his head. If the Tree Killers had fought so savagely, perhaps Laemon would still have his throne. A bolt of lightning came from the air, killing a number of the defenders. Ruark blinked the flash from his eyes, turned to the side, and scanned the surroundings through the blowing winds. There. He motioned for his brothers to stay behind, then slipped forward in a crouch. He grabbed a handful of the gray ash-like dust that covered the ground and rubbed it into his clothing and onto his face. The wind whipped some of it from his fingers. He went prone on the ground, a dagger clenched in his jaw. His prey stood atop a small hill, watching the fight. One of the red veils, with his veil down, grinning. The creature's teeth were not filed to points. The ones with teeth filed to points could all channel. Some without teeth like that could as well. Ruark did not know what that meant. This fellow was a channeler, revealed as he summoned fire like a spear and launched it toward fighting tyrants nearby. Ruark crept forward slowly, inching along the ground in a depression in the rocks. He was forced to watch the red veil killing defender after defender, but he did not speed up. He continued his excruciatingly slow crawl, listening to the fire sizzle as the red veil stood with hands behind his back, weaves of the one power striking around him. The red veil didn't see him. Though some of these men fought like Aiel, many did not. They were not quiet as they stalked and did not seem to know the bow or the spear as well as they should. Men like the one in front of him? Ruark doubted they had ever had to move quietly, sneak up on a foe, kill a deer in the wilderness. Why would they want to, when they could channel? The man didn't notice as Ruark slid around a Trolloc corpse near the Red Veil's feet, then reached out and sliced the man's hamstrings. He dropped with a cry, and before he could channel further, Ruark cut his throat, then slipped back into hiding between two corpses. Two Trollocs came to see what the fuss was. Ruark killed the first, then dropped the second, even as it turned, before they had a chance to see him. Then, once again, he melted into the landscape. No more Shadowspawn came to investigate, so Ruark retreated back toward his men. As he moved, rising to a crouching run, he passed a small pack of wolves finishing off a pair of Trollocs. The wolves turned to him, muzzles bloodied and ears raised. They let him pass, moving silently out into the storm of wind to find other prey. Wolves. They had come with the rainless tempest and now fought alongside men. Ruark did not know much of how the overall battle was going. He could see that some of King Darlin's troops in the distance still held formation. The crossbowmen had set up next to the Dragonsworn. Last Ruark had seen, they'd nearly run out of bolts. And the strange steam-belching wagons that had been delivering supplies now lay in ruins. Aes Sedai and Ashaman continued to channel against the onslaught, but not with the energy he had seen from them earlier. The Aiel did what they did best. Kill. So long as those armies held the pathway to Randalthor, perhaps that would be enough. Perhaps something hit him. He gasped, falling to his knees. He looked up, and someone beautiful stepped through the storm to inspect him. She had wonderful eyes, though the two were offset from one another. He'd never before realized how horribly balanced everyone else's eyes were. Thinking of it nauseated him, and all other women had too much hair on their heads. This creature with thinning hair was far more marvelous. She neared, wonderful, amazing, incredible. She touched his chin as he knelt on the ground, and her fingertips were as soft as clouds. "Yes, you'll do," she said. "Come, my pet, join the others." She gestured toward a group following her. Several wise ones, a pair of Aes Sedai, a man with a spear. Ruark growled. Would this man try to take the affection of his beloved?
He would kill the man for that. He would... His mistress chuckled.
And Moradin thinks this face a punishment. Well, you don't care what face I wear, do you, my pet? Her voice grew softer, and at the same time harsher. When I'm through, nobody will. Moradin himself will praise my beauty, for he will see through eyes that I grant him. Just like you, pet. Just like you.
She patted Ruark. He joined her and the others and moved through the valley, leaving behind the men he had called brothers. Rand stepped forward as a roadway formed itself from threads of light in front of him. His foot fell on a bright, clean paving stone, and he passed from nothingness into majesty. The road was wide enough to let six wagons pass one another at a time, but no vehicles clogged the roadway. Only people, vibrant people, in colorful clothing, chatting, calling, eager. Sounds filled the emptiness, the sounds of life. Rand turned, looking at the buildings as they grew around him. Tall houses lined the thoroughfare, ribbed with columns in front. Long and thin they abutted one another, their faces toward the roadway. Beyond them lay domes and marvels, buildings that stretched toward the sky. It was like no city he had ever seen, though the workmanship was Ogier. Partly Ogier work, that was. Nearby, workers repaired a stone facade that had broken during a storm. Thick-fingered Ogier laughed, rumbling laughs, as they worked alongside men. When the Ogier had come to the Two Rivers to repay Rand for his sacrifice, intending to build a monument here, the town's leaders had wisely requested help improving their city instead. Over the years, the Ogier and Two Rivers people had worked closely together, to the extent that now Two Rivers craftsmen were sought the world over. Rand walked up the roadway, moving among people from all nationalities. Domani trailing colorful, filmy clothing. Tyrans, the division between commoner and noble vanishing more and more by the day, in baggy clothing and shirts marked by striped sleeves. Seanchan wearing exotic silks. Borderlanders with noble airs. Even some Sharans. All had come to Emmons Field. The city now bore little resemblance to its name, and yet there were hints. More trees and open green spaces dotted the landscape than one would find in other great cities, like Camelin or Tyr. In the Two Rivers, craftsmen were revered, and their marksmen were the best the world knew. An elite group of Two Rivers men, armed with the new firing sticks men were calling rifles, served with the Aiel in their peacekeeping campaigns in Shara. It was the only place war was known in the world. Oh, there were disputes here and there. The flare-up between Murundi and Tyr 5 years back had nearly given the land its first real war in the century since the last battle. Rand smiled as he moved through the crowd, not jostling, but listening with pride to the joy in people's voices. The flare-up in Murundi had been dynamic by Fourth Age standards, but in truth it had been nothing. A single disgruntled nobleman had fired on an Aiel patrol. 3 wounded, none dead. And this was the worst fighting in years, outside of the Sharan campaigns. Above, sunlight broke through the thin cloud cover, bathing the roadway in light. Rand finally reached the city square, which had once been the green in Emmons Field. What to think of the quarry road now that it was wide enough to march an army down? He walked around the massive fountain at the center of the square, a monument to those who had fallen in the last battle, crafted by the Ogier. He saw familiar faces among the statuary in the center of the fountain, and turned away. Not final yet, he thought. This isn't real yet. He'd built this reality out of threads of what could be, of mirrors of the world as it now played out. It wasn't set. For the first time since entering this vision of his own design, his confidence shook. He knew the last battle wasn't a failure, but people were dying. Did he think to stop all death? All pain? This should be my fight, he thought. They shouldn't have to die. Wasn't his sacrifice enough? So he'd asked time and time again. The vision quivered, fine stones beneath his feet buzzing, buildings shaking and wavering. The people stopped in place, motionless, sound dying. Down a small side street, he saw a darkness appear like a pinprick that expanded, engulfing everything near it, sucking them in. It grew to be the size of one of the houses, slowly expanding.
"Your dream is weak, adversary."
Rand asserted his will, and the quivering stopped. People who had frozen in place resumed walking, and the comfortable chatter sprang up again. Soft wind blew down the walkway, rustling banners on poles proclaiming celebration.
"I will see that it happens," Rand said to the darkness. "This is your failing. Happiness, growth, love."
"These people are mine now. I will take them."
"You are darkness," Rand said loudly. "Darkness cannot push back light. Darkness exists only when light fails, when it flees. I will not fail. I will not flee. You cannot win so long as I bar your path, Shaitan."
"We shall see."
Rand turned from the darkness and continued doggedly around the fountain. On the other side of the square, a large set of majestic white steps led up to a building 4 stories high and of incredible craftsmanship. Carved with reliefs, topped by a gleaming copper roof, the building was decked with banners. 100 years. 100 years of life. 100 years of peace. The woman who stood at the top of the steps had a familiarity to her features. Some Saldaean heritage, but also dark curls of hair that felt distinctly Two Rivers. Lady Adora, Perrin's granddaughter and mayor of Emmonsfield. Rand walked up the steps as she gave her speech of commemoration. Nobody noticed him. He made it so that they didn't. He slipped like a gray man behind her as she proclaimed the day of celebration. Then he entered the building. It was not a government office, though it might seem so from the front. It was much more important. A school. To the right, grand hallways were hung with paintings and ornaments to rival those of any palace. But these depicted the great teachers and storytellers of the past, from Anla to Tom Marilyn. Rand strolled that hallway, looking in at rooms where any could come and gain knowledge, from the poorest farmer to the children of the mayor. The building had to be large to accommodate all who wanted to learn.
"Your paradise is flawed, adversary."
Darkness hung in a mirror to Rand's right. It reflected not the hallway, but instead his presence.
"You think you can eliminate suffering. Even if you win, you will not. On those perfect streets, men are still murdered at night. Children go hungry despite the efforts of your minions. The wealthy exploit and corrupt. They merely do so quietly."
"It is better," Rand whispered. "It is good."
"It is not enough, and will never be enough. Your dream is flawed. Your dream is a lie. I am the only honesty your world has ever known."
The Dark One attacked him. It came like a storm, a burst of wind so terrible it threatened to rip Rand's skin from his bones. He stood tall, eyes toward the nothing, crossing his arms behind his back. The attack ripped away the vision, the beautiful city, the laughing people, the monument to learning and peace. The Dark One consumed it, and once again, it became mere possibility.
Sylviana held the One Power, felt it flooding her, lighting the world. When she held Sayadar, she felt as if she could see all. It was a glorious feeling, so long as she acknowledged that it was merely a feeling. It was not truth. The lure of Sayadar's power had coaxed many a woman into foolhardy gestures. Certainly many blues had made them, at one point or another. Sylviana sculpted fire from horseback, leveling Sharan soldiers. She had trained her gelding Stinger to never be skittish around channeling.
"Archers, fall back!"
Chubane yelled from just behind her.
"Go, go! Heavy infantry companies, advance!"
The armored foot soldiers marched past Sylviana with axes and maces to confront the disoriented Sharans on the slopes. Pikes would have been better, but they didn't have nearly enough of those for everyone. She wove one more burst of fire into the enemy, preparing the way, then turned her attention to the Sharan archers higher up on the slope. Once Egwene's forces had rounded the bogs, they had split into two assault groups. The Aes Sedai had moved in with the White Tower infantry, attacking Sharans on the heights from the west. By this time, the fires had been extinguished, and most of the Trollocs had moved off the heights to attack below. The other half of Egwene's army, mainly cavalry, were sent into the corridor that skirted the bogs and led toward the ford. They attacked the vulnerable rear flanks of the Trollocs that had come down the slopes to hit Elaine's troops defending the area around the ford. The first group's main job was to make its way up the western slope. Sylviana began aiming a careful series of lightning blasts at the Sharans who were advancing to repel them.
"Once the infantry has forced its way up the slope a ways," Chubane said from beside Egwene, "we'll have the Aes Sedai start." "Mother?"
Chubane's voice had risen. Sylviana spun on horseback, looking with alarm at Egwene. The Amarlin wasn't channeling. Her face had grown pale and she was trembling. Was she being attacked by a weave? Not one Sylviana could see. Figures gathered at the top of the slope, pushing aside the Sharan infantry. They began to channel, and lightning fell on the White Tower army, each with a crack shattering the air and a flash of light bright enough to stun.
"Mother!"
Sylviana kneed her horse up beside Egwene's mount. Demondred must be attacking her. Touching the Sa'angreal in Egwene's hands for an extra boost of power, Sylviana wove a gateway,